No running around. Can I move this down a little farther? What do I do? Sorry, a bit pathetic. There we go, perfect, thank you. Thank you very much. It's quite an act to follow, but I'll try. So I'm going to read a few bits. I'll try and keep an eye on the time. From my novel, Seizure, which has just been published in paperback, so you can buy it very cheaply now. And it was published about a year ago. And just so you have something to go on, it moves back and forth between two stories. The story of Tom, who grows up with his mother somewhere in the north of a country that's a bit like England, and Janet grows up with her father in another country that's a bit like America, which is where I grew up, although I've been here for a long time now. And a lot of it is drawn from traditional material, from ballads. Some of the border ballads come from the north. So I'll see how we go, but I'll try and read probably three little bits. An earthly Norris, it sings. An Irish sings barley way. And little can I, my child's father, nor yet the land that he steps in. Then one arose at her bed feet, and a grumly guest, I'm sure he was, saying, here am I, thy child's father, although I be not comely. I am a man upon the land, I am a silky upon the sea, and when I'm far and far from land, I'm the silky of Sewsgerry. Once upon a time, there was a hunter. He lived in a stone house in a forest not far from the sea. Once, the house had belonged to his mother and his father, but they were long dead, and so the hunter lived alone. Was he lonely? Asked the boy. The storyteller curls her arm tighter around him. Yes, she says, he was lonely, except he didn't know that he was. The boy looks cross. How can you not know that you're lonely? He asks. You always know when you feel something. Well, says the woman, not always. You get used to things. That's how it was with the hunter. He had been alone for so long, he didn't know anything else. Sometimes he would go days without speaking. He heard the voices of the birds, the whisper of the trees, the roar of the sea. Why did he need to speak? One day, just as the sun was about to set, the hunter walked down from his house towards the shore. He had killed a deer and skinned it, and he thought he would wash the blood from his own skin and his knife in the salt water. The summer was nearly over, and it was not as warm as it had been, although the fine hairs on his arms were matted down with the deer's blood. He felt them prickle and try to rise as the breeze blew over him, hinting at the cold that would soon come. He walked more quickly to keep warm on the path that wound a little through the wood, past birch trees and ash trees, their leaves just beginning to turn and drop. Would he eat the deer? The boy asks. The boy has eaten chicken and pork, which he knows is a pig, and beef, which he knows is a cow, but he has never eaten deer. He has never thought about the blood of the animals he's eaten. He's heard stories with hunters in them before, but she has never mentioned the blood. Yes, said the storyteller. He'd eat the deer. Outside his house there was a kind of rack he'd built of ash wood. Some of the deer's meat he'd cut into strips and dry on the rack. You can keep it all winter that way. Some of it he'd smoke inside his chimney. Some of it, the woman thought for a moment, he might take to the village to sell. If there was a village, couldn't he just go there and not be lonely? The woman laughs. If he went to the village, it would be a different story, she said. Which one do you want? This one, says the boy. Good, says the woman. The skin of the deer he might turn into a coat or a rug to put over his bed and keep him warm in the winter. She pulls the quilt up over the boy's lap as she speaks. From the deer's horns he might make the handle of a knife. Nothing would go to waste. So down he went to the sea. In the west, at the horizon, the sun was just setting, a fat, fierce ball that spilled gold on the surface of the water and made him squint and lift a hand over his eyes. The jagged glare made it hard to see. And so it was only when he heard a strange noise that he stopped, quite still, to listen. The hunter was very good at standing still. He could wait for hours, not moving at all in the forest. In his stillness, he would become invisible, and the animals he caught would simply walk towards him, almost willing, it seemed, to be his prey. That's how he stood now, with a sound in his ears that wasn't the call of a bird, or the bark and howl of a wolf, or any noise he'd ever heard before, in the wood or at sea. It was the sound of a woman singing. Now that the hunter heard, he could also see, the woman says. The boy settles himself tighter against her side. They are sitting together on his bed, a bed in another strange new house. He doesn't like this house much, down a narrow street where the other houses press too close, where there is always someone coming or going and you can hear the people next door and wonder if they can hear you. He tries to keep quiet because of that. He climbs up the stairs softly and shuts the door of his room softly. He makes it like a game. He is a spy. No one will catch him. At night, though, when she sits beside him and tells him stories, he can believe that everything is the same as it has ever been, what he'd imagined it had once been. At night, there is no new house, there is no street, there are no neighbors, there is only her voice and the story. Now that the hunter heard, he could also see, the woman says. He moved away, just a little, walking backwards, heel and toe, until he could hide himself behind the broad trunk of an oak. The woman was standing right at the edge of the water, silhouetted by the crimson sun, her feet lapped by the gentle tide. She had a comb in her hand. He couldn't quite make it out, but it must be, and she was drawing it through her dark hair. She tugged at the ends, and as he watched her, he suddenly recalled his mother, how she would sit on the bed and do the same, combing and unknotting her hair before she wove it with swift fingers into a braid. Sometimes the woman broke off her song when she came to a particularly stubborn knot. The breeze carried her voice to him as he stood beneath the oak, and he could hear, it seemed, her every breath. The song had no words he could make out, but was a pretty, simple tune, rising and falling with the drowsy calm of a lullaby. After a little while, when the sun's edge had fallen just below the flat rim of the sea, her strokes became smoother, the knots had gone, her pale arm rose and fell, and he could see now, too, that she wore nothing but her skin. Still he did not move, he did not speak or call out, he watched, as he always did, waiting to see what would come, what would happen next. The woman at the shore threw her thick hair over her shoulder. It reached nearly to her waist. Then she walked with long, sure strides to the uneven shelf of rocks that rose up from the shingle there. It was an expanse of fissured stone. Hard to tell, the hunter had always thought, if they were many stones worn so they lay close alongside each other, or a single stone broken up by deep cracks. She laid the comb down on the flat of the rock and then reached down to one of the cracks and tugged, with much the same gesture as she'd used to pull at her hair, and drew out from the breech an animal skin. It was nothing like the hide he'd taken from the deer. That was rough, pale brown, speckled. This was smooth, dark as her hair, heavy with wet. When she'd gathered it into the crook of her arm, she bent to tuck the comb into the opening where the pelt had been. Then she shook it out and held it away from her, examining it. And once again the hunter remembered his mother, how she would hold one of his shirts against the light to see where it needed mending, narrowing her eyes so her gaze was as sharp as the pins in her sewing basket. The woman drew the skin close to her, right against her breast. Maybe it was then he looked away. He must have looked away, because first she was there and then she was not. And where she had been, there was a seal on the rock, a dark, slender beast with smooth, wet fur and a round black eye. With a swift, liquid undulation that echoed the curl of the waves, it flowed down the shelving stone and, before the hunter could blink twice, slipped away into the sea. For a long time, the hunter didn't move. The sun sank away into the sea, almost as the seal had done. The evening star hung in the violet sky, but the moon was new and dark. It grew colder. Only when the hunter knew he would begin to shiver did he step away from the tree, out from behind it, and not back towards his house, but straight to the shelf of rock. He knelt and reached down as the woman had for her skin, and felt her comb, and found her comb where she'd left it. He held it in his hand and peered at it in the dusk. It was made of bone, with the teeth at one end fine and at the other broad. He was a man who made things with his hands, and he knew this was well made, smoothed on every surface. The sea was calm, and nothing broke through its rippling skin. A gull veered into view, dipping a wing, wheeling on the balance of the air, its watching eye invisible in its black head. The hunter held tight the comb and stood. He began to walk back up the beach, to the path that led through the green forest where the night animals were just beginning to wake. He had forgotten to dip his arms, his knife, in the sea. As the comb warmed in the palm of his hand, the blood of the deer became sticky again and marked the polished bone, the little, fine, sharp teeth. I'll read one last little bit. Those stories are told to Tom by his mother. And Janet, in her separate childhood, also gets told different kinds of stories by her father. Of course, I ask my father for stories. My favorite is how they met, he and my mother, because in it there are ships and icy cold and the possibility that none of this would have happened at all, and so I would not have existed. Chance. Grace, my father calls it, not chance, a kind of gift. It can be very simple. Why Ruth had moved from another school and so was available to be my best friend. What if she hadn't left that other school? Would someone else be my best friend? Would I have somehow found Ruth anyway? That seems very unlikely. My friends are my friends from school. It's hard to imagine Ruth walking around in another part of the city with a different friend. I know this ought to mean I'd have a different friend too, but somehow this is harder to reckon with. I usually end up by thinking that this change of chance, or grace, would mean I'd have no friends at all. Grace can take as well as give. Grace had taken my mother. That's how grace works. You can't know what she'll do. My father tucks me up in bed. Maybe it's winter and the heating whirs comfortingly. I like the sound and will turn it on again in the night if I wake up and find it's turned itself off. The room will get too hot. I am perhaps 8, but this can be any night in any number of years. A little humidifier breathes steam to counter the dryness. Devilbis is the brand, and I will always remember that later, years later. Why should that be when so much else goes? Devilbis, and I've covered it with stickers I trade in class. I have a sticker book with leaves made from waxed paper so the stickers can be peeled off, restuck, and stuck again. Tell me about the ship, I say, how you went on the ship. I have seen ships like the one he went on in the harbor, the big liners, but I haven't been on one myself, and they scare me a little. I think of ships, and I think of shipwrecks, though I don't think of airplanes and plane crashes. So he tells me. His voice is clear in my head, though it's less his voice than the images his voice makes, which are so distinct to me, it's as if I were there myself. He was an architecture student. He was 20, at college, a boy so much younger than I am now, an American boy with American parents. No one in his family had ever been to Europe, not at least since someone must have come from there generations ago, but theirs wasn't a family interested in that kind of history. He'd work nights in a bar up by the school to save for his fare. It was a place on the wide avenue where his professors would come sometimes for beers. Pouring beer, he tells me, was mostly what he did on those nights, but he bought himself a book. He didn't really have the money, but he told himself it was an investment, and learnt to mix drinks. I like to make him say their names, even though I can't imagine the taste of them. They wouldn't taste nice, I know that, but the taste of the words in his mouth and then whispered back in mine is like the taste of neon or mink, Gibson, Martini, Manhattan, Singapore Sling, whiskey, sour. Some drinks had maraschino cherries in them. I like those. We have a jar in the fridge. So he'd saved his money, but it wasn't enough. His father, whose drugstore nearly went belly up in the Depression, my grandfather, who I'd never met, gave him $200. I'd never been so surprised by anything, my father says. The ship was named after a queen. It was June when he sailed on the afternoon tide. Passengers pressed close against the rail, and it was just like in the films, waved their handkerchiefs, and the crowd on the quay waved their handkerchiefs back. Some people had confetti and little party horns. No one had come to see my father off. He was alone, but he didn't mind that, he says. You weren't lonely? I ask. Just because you're alone doesn't mean you have to be lonely, he says. You can be your own good company. You know that. The pleasure of solitude. Solitude. This is a new word. Maybe I was a little lonely, but I liked that, he says. I was with people all the time, at school, when I was working, with my family. I knew everyone all the time. Now I was going where I didn't know anyone, and I could be anything I wanted. It was like being in a story I was making up every day. You understand? I nod. It took nearly a week to cross the sea. A whole ocean. Mostly the weather was fine, and he would stand at the rail watching the blue-black water slide by or the ship slide by the water. You could become hypnotized, wondering which was which. He was traveling third class, sharing his windowless cabin with a nearly silent Pole who just once showed my father black-and-white photographs of his family, a woman and a little boy. It was impossible to tell, my father says, how old the photographs were, and possible to wonder if these people were still alive, but he couldn't ask. Later, when I think of this story, of course, I know that this was less than 20 years after the war, and the story my father's shipmate was trying to tell was most likely not one of reunion, but of permanent, awful separation. It was like a bridge between two worlds, this voyage, my father says. You know how when we walk across the bridge into the city, he says, and there is that time when you are up on the walkway, high over the river, and you are not in one place and not in another, just on the bridge, the place between? It was like that. What was behind, but he didn't know what was ahead. He used to go sometimes in the evenings to a room where there was a vast jigsaw puzzle. I think it had 5,000 pieces, my father says, with a table all to itself. It was an alpine scene, complicated mountains, pale blue sky, lots of grass and a few cows, not an easy puzzle and not a very exciting one either. But he would get a glass of brandy, his daily extravagance, and for a little while shift the pieces about, trying to see if this shade of cerulean blue was the same as that shade, whether male and female. He tells me that's what you call it when one piece can be inserted into another piece. I like the matter-of-factness of this. Would lock together. He would not have done a jigsaw puzzle on land. I never used to think of anything while I was doing it, he says. It was very calming. I mean, just the puzzle. But I wasn't really thinking of it, just feeling my way around, and I could hear the ship's engines and maybe feel it moving, that sense of moving forward. But you don't know into what. He's talking to himself, not to me. I don't mind. I like to listen. I don't really want to go to sleep. I wouldn't mind if he talked all night. Fire engine goes by outside. It's not an ambulance or a police car. They make different sounds. My dad teaches me to notice the difference in things. Time to go to sleep, he says. Enough of the ship. More tomorrow night. Okay, I say. I close my eyes, but I don't sleep. I imagine myself in the windowless cabin. The bed narrower even than mine, steel walls, the water outside, the ocean, moving forward, but you don't know into what. Thank you.